Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 23 of NML Crossing. And this is another one of those late in the day recordings here. I had to try to make sure I could talk. I was hoping that I was just having a little run-in with weird winter allergies, but it's starting to become clearer by the minute that that might not be the case, unfortunately. I thought and I hoped, but I don't know, maybe I'm coming down with the flu, maybe just a cold. Hopefully it's just a short-lived presence in my sinuses, throat, face, all those places that currently ache. Today we've got possibly a shorter episode due to not feeling that great, and also, while it's a good issue we're going to be discussing, there isn't a whole heck of a lot to say about it. Now before we get into it, I almost put up a video yesterday on the Facebook group, but decided against it because I wasn't feeling well, and I felt like I looked pretty terrible at that point. But if you remember, I talked about my journey to collecting everything from No Man's Land, and not too long ago I announced that I had gotten every single issue we needed, and well, that was with one caveat. The caveat being that one very expensive one-shot featuring the first appearance of a character. And I had it in collected. I had a trade paperback with that story in it, and I figured that would suffice. But the caveat I gave was, unless I can find this one issue at a ridiculously affordable price. And, well, I did. I found the Harley Quinn one-shot at a suspiciously inexpensive price. Like, it was a buy it now that was cheaper, or I guess less costly, than the usual opening bid on such a title, or such a book. It was a first print, really good condition. I wrote to the person selling it to get some pictures, because if you're familiar with the book, the price tag on the back is unique for the first printing. It looks kind of unprofessional. It doesn't have like the web address. It's like, it looks weird. So you can tell from at a glance if it's a first print. And the picture he took had that weird UPC and price tag. I've come across people online who have been trying to sell first prints, and then you ask for a picture of the back and it's clearly not. So this one, yeah, it was. So I decided to bite, and I thought it would be fun to do that as like an opening on the Facebook group as a video. But like I said, I wasn't looking great, and I was also a little worried that it was going to be, that I was going to get ripped off. You know, I was really a bit trepidatious. I don't buy things online often, as is widely documented. You know, I talk about that a lot, but so I'm always worried about being taken for a ride. And I guess I just didn't want that saved in perpetuity in video form. So anyway, I got the book. It's in really, really nice condition. It is a first print, and it actually came with a certificate of authenticity, which is weird. Not because it was signed or anything, or because it was part of a special, platinum printing, but it was part of someone's collection. It was part of the Jerome Wanker collection, which is evidently, or was evidently, one of like the three or four largest collections of DC Comics ever. And I'd never heard of it before. And it's weird because I like that kind of information. You know, that's something that Reggie and I were going to do, was a deep dive on, or into, what was called the IRS collection. It was a guy who bought a bunch of comics, owed a bunch of money to the IRS, and like they seized the books, and like they were selling them to make this money back. It was an interesting story. I actually even got in touch with someone involved in it, but that happened right before the pandemic, and then that kind of fell apart. So to have this from like the estate of the Jerome Wanker collection is interesting, and it led me to going into a lot of unexpected rabbit holes yesterday. I guess this Wanker collection is a thing. I'm seeing a lot of it on like the CGC boards. A lot of the, I don't want to say older, because I'm guessing we're like contemporaries now, and I don't want to call myself older, but the more seasoned fans seem kind of aware of this collection here. So I don't know, I just found it interesting, and it was a neat little search to go on to find out more about this collection. Not going to really go too deep into the collection here. Maybe in, you know, several months when we get to that Harley Quinn one-shot, I'll put some information in there just as a pre-ramble of sorts. Of course, if anybody listening has any information or experience with this collection, I would love for you to reach out and let me know. Now, anyway, with all that having been said, and me eating up a few extra minutes of your day, let's get into today's book here. We are, of course, still in the Aftershock era. And our book today is Robin. I think we're calling it Volume 2, Number 54, which had a June 1998 cover date. The story's called Repercussions, written by Chuck Dixon, with pencils by Stas Johnson. Inks Stan Wach, colors Adrian Roy, letters Tim Harkins, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price $1.95. Now we open with Tim paying a visit to Ariana, oh boy, Zhurchenko, I think. Ariana Zhurchenko. He's paying a visit to her house, or at least he's attempting to. Now he finds himself staring down the barrels of several National Guardsmen's rifles, and I tell you what, they look like real a-holes. Now they interrogate our boy, and they seem rather disturbed by the fact that he's trying to visit a Russian. You know, it's like, hey, that sounds Russian. He corrects him and says it's Ukrainian. Now, I don't remember this R.E.D., but I'm going to assume she was a love interest for Tim back in the long ago, which tells me that it's probably not in continuity anymore. You guys know I don't keep up with the newer, the current stuff, but I think Tim has experienced some changes. We talked a little bit about similar stuff when we were doing X-Lapsed with Iceman, but back then I was reading the current stuff, so I was more aware of it. This, I'm not too terribly sure of. Maybe I imagined it, I don't know. Anyway, Tim's told that the neighborhood's been closed off due to quake damage and gas leaks. Many of the residents are currently staying at the high school where a shelter's been set up. And so we follow Tim back to the Drake house, where he sees some scumbaggy-looking dude making a business deal with his naive, bordering on feeble-minded father. I don't remember Tim's dad being such an easy touch. I don't know. The dude says that he can start fixing up the damage of the Drake house right away, and Mr. D hands over a large wad of cash as a deposit. Now, Tim immediately knows that his dad's being taken for a ride here, but he decides to keep it to himself for now. Later that night, after robining up, we go with Tim to that high school. He climbs up on the roof and in via a vent so he can ogle his main squeeze while she sleeps. And it doesn't take him too long to spot her, and he notes that she looks very, very sad. And he assumes that this means that she misses him as much as he misses her. Which, what was that police song? I mean, that sounds like one of them dangerous assumptions, don't it? Anyway, while he scans the sea of displaced humanity, he spots another unwelcome familiar face, that of Stephanie Brown. And he does not seem happy to see her, and he literally says, oh no. We get a close-up of Stephanie, who's trying to calm her mother down. Mrs. Brown, or I guess is it Ms. Brown? She's being quite melodramatic, even blaming herself for the earthquake. Now, Steph gets her to calm down a little bit, and finally she goes to sleep. Just then, a batarang lands in her bed. She looks up to the rafters and spots the boy Wonder. Moments later, the two meet up outside at the basketball courts. Stephanie immediately latches onto Tim, which he does not seem too pleased with. She then asks him for a favor. Now you see, in the rush to vacate their neighborhood, she forgot her spoiler costume and needs Robin to go fetch it. Didn't she, I don't know, wear her spoiler costume under her clothes for like a simple trip to the mall the day of the quake? How could she possibly forget it? Oh well, I guess a MacGuffin's gonna be a MacGuffin, right? Now, she says that she's worried that looters are gonna find it and discover her secret, which is kind of adorable that she thinks anybody would possibly care. This is Chris from the future checking in. I had to edit out a bad coughing fit here. I wonder how long it's going to take for me to edit this episode. It's Not ideal. Not ideal. Anyway, back to our story here. We're with Spoiler, and she fills Tim in on what happened during the Blunt Trauma one-shot that we discussed several episodes ago. She talks about meeting up with the Huntress, also letting her father escape so the Huntress didn't kill him. And even old Ernie Chubb gets a mention. If you remember, Chubb got KO'd by Huntress. Now, Stephanie decides not to take Tim's no for an answer. He's like, how am I going to get to your house? There's the National Guard everywhere. They got guns. They're shooting on sight. But she doesn't take no for an answer. And so our boy is left holding the bag. He's going to have to head to the Brown House and retrieve that costume. And so next thing we know, Tim is back in that neighborhood. Lucky for him, the National Guard are all too focused on playing Game Boy to notice him swooping by. And yeah, that's actually what they're doing. He works his way towards Stephanie's house, and upon arrival, quickly realizes that he's not alone. He's not alone because the Cluemaster is there, which I usually spell Cluemaster because he's boring and makes me want to go to sleep. Now, Artie, he's sitting there, he's got the spoiler suit, and he reveals that he ransacked the house for the hell of it. Like, just for fun. He just ransacked his family's house. He also had some things hidden there. Things like cash, a spare costume, and the gun that he's currently pointing at Robin. Tim suggests that they continue this conversation quietly, since there is a literal army sitting right outside. Naturally, Arthur's response to this is to open fire. Well, that sucks, because before we know it, the place is swarming with guardsmen who are also content to open fire. Remember, limited martial law, loot and shoot. Arthur leaps out the window, and having run through his supply of ammunition, decides to just throw his piece at Tim. They then fall into a flimsy above-ground pool in some backyard, maybe theirs, I don't know, where they wrestle around a bit before it gives way. The National Guard are quick to spot Cluemaster, since he's wearing basically a glow-in-the-dark orange costume. His outfit is so loud and gaudy that they don't even notice Robin, which is saying something, right? And he's able to make his escape while the guards chase Brown. Tim's able to make his way back to his Redbird mobile, but before he leaves, he recognizes a nearby parked van. He realizes that it belongs to that skeez who ripped off his dad earlier in the day. And so Tim pops his head into the van and sees the would-be scammers fast asleep. He opens the door, grabs an envelope full of cash out of the glove box, and then slashes their tires for good measure. He says he'll call this in to Shotgun Smith the next morning so he can follow up. Back at the high school, Tim tells Stephanie that he did secure her spoiler costume. But he's decided he's going to hold on to it for a bit, until they have a chance to really sit down and talk. Now, Stephanie takes this to mean that Tim was only at the high school because he's been crushing on her so hard. He tries to tell her that, you know, isn't the case at all, but she's not buying it. She even says that Tim's got himself a bad case of the Stephs, or a Steph infection, if you will. Oh, okay, she didn't actually say that last part. Now, Tim heads back into the rafters for a beat so he can watch the girl he actually does have a bad case of sleep for a while. We're really walking the line between romantic and weird. Now, the next morning, Tim gives his dad his money back. He doesn't reveal to him that he'd been scammed, just that Mr. Durston, which is the scumbag who ripped him off, realized that he was overbooked, and so he just credited everybody their money back. Oh, or gave it the back, I guess it was cash. Mr. Drake threatens action with the Better Business Bureau, which... okay, dude. Tim heads outside, where he runs right into R.E.D. They embrace, and they decide to start things over, so I'm guessing their last go-round ended acrimoniously. I can't say for certain, but I'm going to assume that. Anyway, we wrap up with them driving away, and Tim promising that nothing will ever tear them apart again. In a neat bit of symbolism, that spoiler costume is right there between them in the back seat, which is a pretty cool visual. But that's where we leave it. Next time out, we're going back to the flagship. We're looking at Batman 556. So let's talk about this one here. And like I said, there isn't much to say about the issue itself, but the pacing and the way it was crafted, maybe we'll talk about it a little bit. Because this one was a lot of fun for me. It was oddly nostalgic as well. And I say oddly because I'd never read this before, so it didn't necessarily take me back to a particular time in Tim Drake's life or anything. It just kind of took me back to the teenagery stories we seem to get a lot back in the mid to late 90s, where you have like this neat balance between slice of life and superheroics. And it's like the likes of which I don't think we get too much of anymore. And again, this is an uninformed statement, of course, because I don't really keep up so much anymore with the new stuff. But when I did, it seemed like stories like this would have to go like one or the other, right? Like, this is a balance between teenagery stuff and hero stuff, where now it's either or. Or any attempt to include both usually ends up like shortchanging one of them or comes across as just plain shallow. I guess that's more a sign of the times and the way in which comics are made now than really an indictment on anything else. Like, the one example I tend to go to a lot, especially when we were doing Titan stuff, was the Rebirth era Teen Titans, where it felt like any attempt at humanizing the characters was very inorganic, almost like shoehorned in. It's like we had to be reminded, it's like, these are teenagers, and these are things that teenagers deal with, so they're just arguing all the time, and they're awful to one another, and it just didn't work for me. But here, we have this nice little mix, and really makes me miss the, you know, this era of comics. Now, I like the idea of Robin trying to address things both in and out of his costumed life. I don't remember this R.E.D. girl, so I'm guessing she won't be around all that much longer. Full disclosure, I started picking up Robin regularly around the, what was it? I don't know if you remember this. It was probably a little bit after No Man's Land ended. And it was this weird theme month for Batman, for the Bat books. And it's like, this issue, ... Batman dies. You know, and it was these, I guess, imaginary stories or gimmick stories where Batman dies in every single issue of a Batman-related book. And I think that was like the first time I picked up Robin, and then I just stuck around and became a, you know, a pseudo-completionist. But I definitely don't remember this Ari character at any point when I was actually, like, actively buying it. Now, I really like Spoiler acting as the Spoiler. Now, she's definitely got feelings for Robin. And it seems as though with every issue, she gets a little bit closer to finding out who is beneath the mask. I think that's really, really cool. It's a nice slow burn. And it makes her, I don't know, it just makes her a very fun character. Now, the symbolism of the Spoiler costume being between Tim and Ari, I thought that was really cool. And I would have to assume that it definitely foreshadows what, you know, all Tim might have on his personal life plate in the months and maybe years to come. We got Clue Master, and I think he still kind of sucks. And I get that he's important due to the fact that he's Steph's dad. But unfortunately, that just isn't enough for me to find him in any way interesting. But at the same time, I understand the need for there to be some action in every issue. Another, you know, definite sign of the times, and a reminder that we're reading a comic from before the days of decompressed storytelling, where they tried to do, you know, relatable human elements and action. I suppose his inclusion here was mostly harmless, and it did facilitate the spoiler-centric beats of the story, so can't get too mad at it. Overall, this very much felt like the old post-crossover, you know, quote-unquote quiet issues we used to get back in the day. And that's always going to be a good thing. I mean, we talked about that a lot during X-Lapsed, you know. One of the things that I think the Nicieza and Lobdell eras of X-Men are known for or remembered for are the quiet human stories that would usually follow up a, you know, long and bloated crossover, which, yeah, I loved it. I loved those because back then we were allowed to just take a breath after an event, right? We were allowed to recover, and we recovered with our cast, and we can catch back up with them and get some of their thoughts and their reflections, and it just, I don't know, it felt like, it's going to sound real, real precious, but it almost felt like we were part of those stories because we just went through a crossover just like they did. And here we are just like, whew, okay, now this is what we learned and this is where we go from here. Nowadays, and now, I hate saying nowadays. By now you probably know I hate saying nowadays. But nowadays, we don't get these all that much. In fact, we usually don't even get an issue of a book after a crossover ends. We're usually treated with a brand new number one after every crossover. So we get zero opportunity for any sort of come down or natural segue into the next phase or status quo for our hero or our heroes. And I don't know, I think it's a damn shame. Here, though, we get that, right? The cataclysm's over. We're not out of the woods yet. There's still a lot of work to be done, and we're not done with Robin by any stretch, right? But here we get to take a breath. We get to take a beat with him and kind of just see what the new lay of the land is and try to navigate it as best we can with him. So definitely a fun issue, worth a read. A nice, quiet, come-down sort of vibe. So check it out if you have it available or if you want to track it down. I mean, this is pretty much what we've come to expect from Chuck Dixon. It's a really good mix of character work and action. So I think I'm done babbling about the issue here. I'm going to work our way toward the tail end of the program here. If you listened to last episode, you'll know I shoved a Flashback Land segment in. It was me looking at some old Usenet news and transcripts of DC Comics chats on AOL and stuff. And no segment today, but I've been doing a lot more digging here, and I think there's going to be a lot of fun food for thought in those old comments and those old chat transcripts and stuff. So there will be more of those coming up. I've already been compiling a bunch of good ones here, and I think we're going to be faced with some pretty interesting challenges. In the first handful of episodes of this program, I came up against some challenges with the realistic or unrealistic nature of this entire storyline. You know, I've said silly things like, why didn't the Justice League just fix the town? You know? And it's those sticking points that really hurt your ability to just, like, let go and enjoy the story for what it is. And so many of these posts on Usenet are pretty much saying exactly what I said. You know, it's like, how could this possibly happen here? It's a shared universe. There's heroes everywhere. There's aliens everywhere. There's gods everywhere. How did this happen? How did this stay the way it was for so long? And I think that's going to be a big part of the challenge here. And I want to challenge my own sort of preconceptions and issues I might have with the quote-unquote reality of this entire No Man's Land era. Because, I think I talked in last episode about how I have the rose-colored glasses when I think about Usenet. And I coming to discover here, the more I dig, the bigger of an echo chamber it was. And this is going back like a quarter century. So, I mean, these aren't new phenomenon, you know, thanks to social media. This is just kind of the way fans are. Like, it's to the point where I don't know how anybody would willingly get into the comics industry having to deal with people like me, you know, as your customer base. It's interesting. It's going to be interesting here. Challenging preconceptions is never easy. I remember I started college when I was 31. You know, I started very, very late. And one of the common, you know, chestnuts among returning students is that the hardest part is going to be, like, forgetting everything you've learned in real life. You know, because none of that really applies to academics. And sometimes your life experiences fly in the face of what you're being taught. It's like complete 180-degree opposite, you know. So it's hard to shut that part of your brain off here and just be in it for the purpose of learning of what you're, whatever the class is on or whatever the comic book is about. You're just trying to be here for the story, for the ride. And I mean, if I had a nickel for every person on Usenet who said they're dropping the Batman books during this era, I'd be on that golden yacht somewhere. You know, it's pretty crazy. People are calling for Denny O'Neil's job just because the story doesn't feel realistic. It's a comic book. And the buzz phrase on Usenet around this time is internal logic, which I think I've seen defined about a dozen different ways. So they can't agree on what it means. All they know is that this story doesn't have it. So I'm looking forward to sharing those things as we get closer to to go time on the actual No Man's Land proper. But did want to just mention that that sort of content will be coming here and again, and I can't wait for us to get into like letters pages and stuff, because I wonder if those will be as pessimistic or as blame Denny-ish as the Usenet posts are. I guess we'll have to wait and see. We don't have to wait too long, thankfully. We'll get there before we know it. But with that out of the way, let's hop into the NML bag here. It's going to be a quick one, because my throat is in the middle of closing up on me. So we're going to check in with our friend Chris Yu, and he's talking about Robin 52, which was the first Robin chapter in Cataclysm, the Red Skies crossover, we called it. And Chris says, "This book only had the Cataclysm trade dress because of the month it came out. I hate it when editorial and the creative team can't get on the same page so that one story can end before one begins. They could have made the previous issue of Robin oversized in order to wrap up the storyline before Robin had to cross over with Cataclysm. This issue could have started with Tim's plane landing and then be about him trying to figure out what happened and how to get back into Gotham City." And yeah, you know, I totally agree with that in theory, right? I think one thing a lot of us have learned about comics, and maybe DC in particular, is the astonishing lack of forethought. You know, they spent a half decade trying to tell us that the New 52 was something they were planning for years, when there were sure signs that it was a last-minute decision. You know, on the blog I covered the first six or seven issues of the Brightest Day era Flash, which was the first Barry Allen Flash ongoing in, you know, a very, very long time, and how at a certain point the story kind of changed to kind of break away from the Brightest Day story and move toward Flashpoint. It tells me that the New 52 was probably in the works for less than a quarter of a year before they pulled the trigger on it. Again, I don't have any inside knowledge. I don't, you know, nobody in DC would ever talk to someone like me. But from a storytelling perspective, and Geoff Johns is a great writer. He's not a bad writer by any stretch. So for him to write such a weirdly paced and disjointed story just doesn't wash for me. I think it was something that was very spur of the moment, very short-sighted. The goal there was, let's beat Marvel for a month, and I think they did just that. Here with Cataclysm, I'm pretty convinced that this was kind of spur of the moment as well. So within like a couple months before they actually launched it, and at which point the Robin book had been paced and written and probably mostly drawn, so I think that would have been hard to... I think it would have been hard to make that into, you know, having issue 51 be oversized, because issue 50 was probably oversized as it was. I don't know. One of the numbers, I hate to go back to using that again, but there was a number being bandied about there about how much the Bat books have been suffering in the sales department for the past few years before Cataclysm. I guess Denny said they stopped doing crossovers with Legacy, which was like a year and a half before. And in that time, it said that the Bat books dropped in sales by 20%. So that's like one in every five people buying the Batman books is no longer buying the Batman books. I think that might have stoked some panic. And again, I have no access to hard and fast numbers. This is just the number that kept coming up in my research. I mean, we looked at the Wizard top 100 list here, and the Bat books were barely in the 30s. So, I mean, that's not great, especially for a flagship character for an entire comic book universe, you know? So if the sales did drop by 20%, I could see them rushing to this constant crossover style of storytelling and doing it at the very last minute, you know, fitting it in just as soon as they could, as soon as they can wrap up everything else. And I'm sure Robin was probably more an afterthought than anything. It was just like, we need to sell more copies and throw the crumbling pink building on the left-hand side of the cover and we'll sell X amount more. And from what we saw in Wizard the other day, yeah, they did. It worked. It brought everything back up. I think they set upwards of 5% in the first month. So it definitely worked in their favor. And I definitely think they didn't have quite as much lead-in time to this as they might want us to think. It's another case of the rose-colored glasses, isn't it? Like I talk about editorial now, and how books contradict each other in the same week, and how everything seems rushed and just extended at the same time. And I like to think back to, you know, my early days in the hobby here, and think that it was different back then. And then you realize, no, not really. It was always kind of like this. But I want to thank Chris so much for sharing his thoughts on the Red Sky crossover that was Robin 52. And of course, if anybody out there has any comments about anything that I say here, I would love to hear from you. I encourage and invite all comments. You can reach me all those different ways. WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com. There's also GothamQuake.com that goes right to Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com. 90s X-Men on Facebook, Ace Comics on the other stuff. And before I head off to goggle some warm salt water, I want to thank you all so much for letting me into your ears today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks, starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You better turn that page. When push it comes to shove, we do not fall out of love.